FM 89.9 Blue Hill and on the web at WERU.org.
Support for WERU is made possible by our listeners and by U.S. Bells in Prospect Harbor, offering cast bronze wind bells, doorbells, and custom hardware. 963-7184 or usbells.com.
The time is just a few seconds before 10 o'clock, and you are tuned to WERU-FM 89.9 Blue Hill and streaming online at weru.org. And good morning and welcome to this WERU special. I'm Amy Brown. Universal health care, is it possible in Maine? That was the topic of a discussion at an event held in Belfast on Monday, featuring Dr. Phil Caper of Maine All Care, who advocated for universal health care, and Matt Gagne of the Maine Heritage Policy Center promoting free market alternatives. Jim Campbell, whose voice you may recognize from WERU's Notes from the Electronic Cottage, was the moderator. Matt Murphy recorded the discussion, most of which you'll hear today. The event ran for more than an hour, so in addition to what we'll be bringing you today, the full recording will be available on our archives at weru.org either later today or tomorrow.
Welcome. I'm Jim Campbell. I'll be the traffic director for this conversation. And with me tonight is...
I'm Matt Gagne. I am the CEO of the Maine Heritage Policy Center, which is a position I've held for the last 5 years.
Okay.
And I'm Phil Caper. I'm a retired internist, and I am a founding board member of Maine All Care. Served on the board for about 10 years.
Okay. Our topic this evening is universal health care in Maine. And so a good idea, perhaps, is to start off by saying, what do we mean by universal health care? So since you're from Maine All Care, why don't you give us a start and tell us what that term means in your vocabulary?
Well, what it means is that health care covers everybody.
Well, in terms of cost, or in what terms does health care cover?
I'd like to see everybody be able to fully participate in the health care system, no matter who they are, what their income is, what their job is. We think that health care should be available to everybody.
Okay. Matt, do you have a different idea of what that term means?
I don't think so. I mean, I think that's a fine definition of it. To me, the only caveat I would add to it is that I think as we're considering any healthcare system, whether it's the United States system, whether it's one of the ones you see in Europe or Canada or somewhere else, I think you have to have in your mind something beyond insurance. Insurance coverage by itself is what most people think of when they think of universal health care. You know, am I insured? Do I have access to health care if I need it? And I think that's an important step. I mean, that's something you really do need to take into consideration. But the other part is actually access. It's whether or not you're able to see a doctor and whether or not you're able to actually access health care. And that's a debate I'm sure that we'll have as we continue this conversation a little bit about exactly how best to design a system that meets as many people's needs as cheaply and effectively as possible for any system that we end up designing. I think that's really something that we need to keep in mind, because a lot of times what we have found is that insurance is not necessarily access, and that's something we always need to keep in mind.
Okay, so if we more or less agree on what we mean by universal health care, a lot of people think that that is a human right. Do you folks?
Phil, would you like to take this one?
Well, I think everyone should have access to it. Whether you call it a right or not is less important than seeing that everybody has access to it.
In that case, you're saying it's something that is desirable, that ought to be, but it's not necessarily something that would be covered, for example, by rights under our Declaration of Independence or Constitution.
Well, since you mentioned the Constitution, let me just read something for just a minute here. We, the people of the United States, in order to form a more perfect union, establish justice, ensure domestic tranquility, provide for the common defense, promote the general welfare, okay, and secure the blessings of liberty to ourselves and our posterity, do ordain and establish this Constitution for the United States of America. It's the preamble to the Constitution. Provide for the general welfare is one of the first things the founders addressed when they drafted the Constitution.
That's a very general term, however, providing for the general welfare. Matt, would you say, in your way of looking at the world, that access to health care is a human right?
I've never found the statement health care is a human right to be terribly fair to the conversation. I mean, it's such a complex issue, health care in general, that that term specifically, that it's a human right, is very political in nature. I mean, you see it at political rallies. You hear candidates for president saying it. And I think that it oversimplifies the issue. I mean, at the bare minimum, what we're talking about here is access to what about basically amounts to a commodity. Healthcare is a finite resource. And if there is not enough of the resource to go around, it's very difficult to call it a right. You know, if you have, for instance, one doctor and 10 people that need to see the doctor, you can say it's a right all you want, but you have 9 people who can't see the doctor in that particular moment.
Because of some technical issues, there's a gap of about 2 to 3 minutes here, rejoining the conversation.
So from your perspective, the question of cost is one that is simply a misallocation of resources in a certain way, that we are spending a huge amount of money on the healthcare system, but from your perspective, we're not getting the results that people would like to have in terms of access.
Right.
The question that Matt brought up, and maybe you want to speak to this, is let's just say, for the sake of argument, that tomorrow morning there was universal health care in Maine. Would there be universal health care access in Maine?
Well, I think what we're proposing at Maine AllCare is quite a pretty profound change in the structure of the healthcare system. And even if we were able to enact legislation tomorrow, we could not implement such a drastic, dramatic change quickly. It would have to be done in a planned way, and it would have to be done over a period of time, because it would be a shock to the system we now have. And a lot of people interact with that system, either as patients or employees or caregivers. And we'd have to carefully program a just transition to make sure that people, and some people will be displaced if they're employed in things that are going to go away, such as insurance underwriting would go away. For those who aren't familiar with insurance underwriting, the best known example is the exclusion of pre-existing conditions by insurance companies. That's what they do, because they don't want to take on a person, they don't want to insure a person with a high risk of using medical care. So, but the medical underwriting goes far beyond that. It's a way of pricing risk based upon your probability of using medical care. So if you have a high probability, let's say you're diabetic, of using medical care, your premium is going to be higher. And that makes insurance, that makes great sense from an insurance point of view. That's the way all insurance policies work, which is why better insurance, Matt was absolutely correct, better insurance is not the answer. Insurance itself is one of the big problems. We should move away from financing health care with insurance, and healthcare, we believe, should be financed as a public good, similar to our roads, our police departments, our fire departments, our public schools, our public libraries, our legislatures, and our judiciary. These are all public goods that we finance through taxes. And that, you know, Oliver Wendell Holmes once said, taxes are the price of civilization. And universal health care is the mark of a civilized society.
You know, the interesting thing about this conversation is that the words "it depends" comes up in my mind an awful lot when we're talking about this. Because when you hear things like every industrialized country in the world basically does one thing and we don't. It's not really true because they all have very different systems. I mean, what Singapore does, what the Nordic countries do, what the UK does, what Canada does, they all have some level of universal insurance in some fashion, but the way that they actually do the funding mechanisms, who gets insured how, who pays what, it's radically different in a lot of these countries. In fact, there are some countries that have that preserve a private system that sort of funnels through a government entity, but maintains some form of private insurance. So yeah, I think it's difficult to really classify the rest of the world one way and us another. But more importantly, we're hearing now about cost. I mean, that's basically what any debate about this really boils down to in the end. And what I find ironic about the argument that the government should basically take the place of insurers is the notion that the government would behave all that differently from an insurance company. Governments, just like insurers, are subject to basically money in and money out, what they have available to pay in resources and what they have coming in to actually pay those things. You bring up roads, internet infrastructure, any number of things that we consider a public good. And in virtually all of those instances, you're thinking of crumbling roads and things that are unmet needs in a lot of ways. Vermont tried to do this. Vermont actually attempted to put in place its own single-payer healthcare system when Governor Pete Shumlin signed a bill in 2011, basically instituting one. It had a target date for 2017, and they were working very hard on implementation. And as they were doing, their prep work for this, they were basically asking themselves very basic questions. What's covered? What isn't? What procedures are covered? Who do we pay and how much do we pay? Things like that. The more that they went into it, the more the costs began to add up. And at the end of the day, before they ended up pulling the plug on it, they were looking at something like $2.5 billion for the first year of implementation. The budget for Vermont was at the time, $2.7 billion. So basically, you're looking at doubling your budget for the institution of this type of program, which is fine. If you'd like to do that, that's fine. I'm not suggesting you can't or you shouldn't or what have you, but I do think it's very important for you to keep in mind real cost, and government has to find a way of bearing that cost. Ultimately, that's why Shumlin, who was among the most visionary, I think, leaders in the Medicare for All type movement, ended up saying no at the end, because they just simply could not find a politically feasible funding mechanism inside Vermont to actually make that happen. The real reason that happened is because the taxes that would be necessary to implement that kind of a system essentially would have gone up, I think it was to 11.5% on the payroll side, and I think 9% on income taxes. So essentially doubling what they already paid. And when you're a state like Vermont, you are going to be subject to the trickle-down effect of what that does. What are people who live in Vermont going to do when they see that happen? Sure, you can make an argument a lot of people will be healthier, they'll be happier, they have things covered that they didn't have before. But also, you're going to be facing a situation where a lot of people will be moving out of the state. They'll be facing taxes they didn't have yesterday. They have the ability to move out. It's something we experience in Maine even without this type of problem right now. A lot of our residents end up moving down to Florida or Arizona or a number of other states because of a variety of tax advantages. That's going to be the case no matter what you do, state by state. And it's also going to be something that happens if you institute it nationwide. I think that it would be wrong to assume, particularly with what we've seen with the corporate income tax rate in the United States, that if you were to double it, or even more than that, that it wouldn't have a massive impact on the economy. It would impact jobs, it would impact economic growth, it would impact population movement and a lot of things. And those are things you really do have to consider, because that provides the tax base for you to fund these types of programs, and it's a real consideration. So I would ask that you guys think about that, because the cost of the national proposal, according to the Mercatus Center, was something in the neighborhood of $32.5 trillion over the course of 10 years. And that most likely is a conservative estimate. There's been other estimates that say 27. There's been others that say 40. But they all take a basic calculation into effect that keeps the Medicare reimbursement rate kind of where it is right now. And if you did away with private insurance, which pays a great deal more than Medicare reimbursement, then what you'd be facing is doctors getting paid less for doing the procedures they are. In fact, a lot of times, less than the cost of the care that they're providing. So that doesn't mean they'd necessarily go out of business, but it would be harder for them to actually make ends meet. They'd be getting paid less. It'd be less attractive to become a doctor in the United States. And you would most likely be seeing less doctors. And if you see less doctors, that gets into the supply and demand curve that I was talking about at the beginning of this, where you're going to have fewer people to provide the healthcare service you want, and more to consume it, because you're going to have insurance coverage everywhere. So I think that's a major reality that has to be faced by this kind of question.
How does that strike you? How does that analysis strike you?
Well, I actually agree with much of what Matt said. There are lots of ways to skin this cat. European countries have a variety of systems, but the bottom line is, in those countries, everybody has guaranteed access to health care, and when they get sick, they don't even think about the cost because it's all prepaid. Everybody contributes to the system, and everybody benefits from the system. So that's, to me, is the important point. And is the question I guess I have is, are they that much smarter than we are that they've been able to figure this out and we haven't? What's the problem here? What are the barriers to reform in the United States? And as far as, this problem is, I used to say 95%, but I will now say 100% political. This is not a technical problem. If we were able to develop the political will to do this, and if our political system would let us do it, that's another issue, the corruption of the political system, but if we could figure out a way to counter that, there's no question that we are now spending enough money to have the best world-class medicine for everybody in the country, better than any other country, because they're not spending anywhere near what we are on health care. So that's, and as far as Vermont is concerned, Vermont legislature did pass that bill. What Matt said was correct, but my analysis of what happened is that it was a failure to inoculate, is the term we use, the population against the need for a significant tax hike. And those taxes are not new spending. They're redirecting what we're already spending. Because according to the Institute of Medicine, which is now part of the National Academy of Sciences, in a study they did in 2012, out of the $3 trillion we're spending, $750 billion of that, that's 25%, is waste that could be eliminated without affecting anybody's access to health care or the quality of health care. And that study has since been validated many times. The Mercatus study did show that what we were proposing would cost $2 trillion over 10 years. What they neglected to mention is that if we continue in our present system, it would cost several trillion more than that.
It would cost several trillion more than that, but not in government expenditures.
That's correct.
And what I think that's really important, and I think the Vermont example is incredibly illuminating, because it's not that you're wrong, because the total spending in the healthcare system is preposterous in the United States. I am certainly not sitting in this chair to defend the current system we have, because I find it grotesque. It's an amalgamation of about 60 years of healthcare compromises from 10 different areas and practitioners and hospitals and insurance companies and politicians and whatnot. And what you've ended up with is a nightmare scenario. And I cringe every time somebody calls it a free market healthcare delivery system, because it's not. It just isn't. Nor is it a universal single-payer health system or anything. But the Vermont example is really illuminative, because what you heard there is true in raw dollars, right? The recommitting of dollars in that way is, in fact, something that would save money, and the money that they're paying in some ways, like, for instance, employer reimbursements for healthcare, right? That then becomes a government responsibility, and it's taken out in taxes with the corporation, right? Overall, it's the same or less. But for individual people who own the businesses, for instance, it's significantly higher. It's significantly higher because of the payroll tax increase that they were going to be doing, as well as the income tax hike they were going to be doing. And the main reason why they shied away from it in Vermont was because of the testimony of a lot of these businesses that showed up in the legislature when they were proposing the funding mechanisms. And they were saying, I will simply leave. I will not be here. Because that's going to be significantly, significantly more than what I currently pay. I'm not asking you to find that moral or ethical. That's a different debate. I think we can have a capitalism debate some other time, but it is the reality of the situation. They do not have to actually live in Vermont, and nor do they have to live in the United States. And when costs end up making it not feasible for you to do so, people vote with their feet. And in Maine, what we see is in the current structure of the tax system with a combination of income taxes and particularly estate taxes, with as old of a state as we are, if you have any level of wealth whatsoever, by the time you start spending 2 or 3 months in Florida, you start spending 5, 6, or 7 months in Florida, and you move your assets down there, and then you prepare your estate for whatever it is you pass to pass on what you've earned in your life to your children, because you can, because Florida is different. And people make those choices. They really do. I mean, talk to any financial advisor, and you'll find literally hundreds, if not thousands, of people that they can point to that have already made that decision. And so you're going to be facing real consequences if you make that type of a switch in the United States today in 2019. So you have to keep that in mind.
You're listening to a WERU special. This discussion of universal health care was recorded on Monday, October 14th in Belfast. The panelists are Dr. Phil Caper of Maine All Care and Matt Gagne of the Maine Heritage Policy Center. Jim Campbell is the moderator. You just heard from Matt Gagne. Next to speak is Dr. Phil Caper.
I think that you make a good point, Matt. We agree on a great deal of number of things. Would you be interested in a board position on an advocacy organization?
Well, you know, the interesting thing...
We can talk about that later.
You know, you joke, clearly our philosophies are not aligned, because I think that access to health care can be delivered in ways that don't involve $32 trillion of government expenditures. But one thing that I hope everybody who's listening to this can take away from the conversation is that I think that, at least in intent, virtually all of us are the same. I mean, I have four kids, and the last thing in the world I want is for one of them to not have health insurance and then have some sort of a medical need and then face, you know, dire consequences from that, or my friends or anyone in this room. So we have to believe in each other's, I think, good-natured intentions on this type of thing. Otherwise, this debate will never go anywhere. It will absolutely never go anywhere, because I really do think that most people, when it comes to education, health care, and a lot of other questions, are essentially the same in goals. But perhaps just have different philosophies on how to approach it.
Well, I think that's certainly true. But again, I think, and you know, if we were, say, the only state or the first state to implement a universal health care system on a state level, which incidentally would be very difficult. I'm not minimizing the difficulty of doing this. But the reason I brought up the issue of this being a political issue is that the only way we're going to be able to make the changes I believe are necessary to make the system much more patient-friendly, friendly to doctors, is to essentially greatly simplify the system and create a system which gives people the security, the kind of security they have in almost every other wealthy country. And I would bet that if we were able to do that, we would attract a lot of people into the state from places where they can't get health care, and where, like in Maine, now health care is one of their major concerns. So it's impossible to predict exactly what would happen. In addition to that, our current system is killing the doctors. The doctors are faced with complexity of our system, dealing with hundreds or thousands of insurance companies, each one slightly different, and are being driven out of solo practice and being acquired by large corporate conglomerates. We have three of them now in Maine, or four, depending on how you define things. But I think that the fact that the physician burnout is a major concern of people in the medical profession. Just ask the Maine Medical Association, and they'll tell you. And it's gotten so frustrating for the doctors because of the administrative burden and because of the constant interference in our clinical decision-making, which is an affront to our professionalism, of denying claims, making the doctors and their staff work to get permission, mother may I, to do tests, prescribe drugs, do procedures we think are in the patient's interest. So it's, and that's what I think is really driving the doctors to despair. In 2008, the Maine Medical Association did a survey about how doctors felt about our current public-private insurance system versus a single-payer, highly simplified system. And in 2008, about 51% of the doctors said they preferred what we call the single-payer solution. We repeated that survey in 2014, and it was now up to 65% of the doctors who answered that survey said we would prefer to deal with a Medicare-like system rather than what we have now. And we describe it as Medicare-like because this is not a theory. Medicare has been tested for the last 50 years. It's one of the most popular, that and Social Security, two of the most popular programs ever enacted. They are both run by the federal government. And people it's really, Medicare is very popular with people, as opposed to the Affordable Care Act, which retains our current insurance-based system, which, as you know, I'm sure, is very unpopular with a lot of people. So you have to ask the question, why is Medicare so popular to the extent that no politician will take it head on? They may try to subvert it if they disagree with government insurance philosophically, but no politician will get up and say, I want to get rid of your Medicare, because they'd be out of office at the first opportunity if they did that. So how are these two programs different? Why is one so popular and the other one so contentious? I mean, the ACA has been under constant political attack since the day it was enacted, and that continues, as you know. And it's still threatened through cases that are now in the courts. So there's something that makes the ACA, the Affordable Care Act, vulnerable, and Medicare invulnerable. Why do you think that is?
Well, I can answer that question in a moment, but I do want to also tackle one thing you said, which I agree with. The cost to a doctor, for instance, of dealing with the current medical insurance system that's in the United States is ridiculous. I mean, it's something like $80,000 per doctor. And in Canada, I believe, for instance, I think it's $22,000. And that is, to me, your best argument. It's the best argument for why you should go to some other kind of system, because the one that we have now is terrible, and that would be, in theory, a cheaper system.
But can I just interrupt you for a second?
Yeah, please.
You know, I don't know what your academic background is, but you're talking like an economist in the sense that we're focused on the monetary cost. Mm-hmm. What really gets under our skin as doctors is the challenge to our professionalism. You know, I went to school for 12 years to get my not medical school, but after high school, 12 years after high school, another 4 years in my residency, another couple of years in my fellowship. So that's a lot of time to become an expert, to learn to be a doctor, and to have our professionalism and our professional judgment constantly challenged is the most insulting part of our current system. And I don't really blame the insurance companies for doing this. They're just doing what they do. Insurance companies medically underwrite, which is an insurance company way of describing discriminating against sick people or people who may become sick. And they don't like to pay out claims. They resist paying out claims because they're
so is the government, though.
They're for-profit entities whose primary objective, their primary responsibility, as they see it, is to their shareholders. And I agree with that. They're doing what they're supposed to be doing. They're minimizing what they call their medical losses in order to maximize their profitability. And I don't blame them for that. They're required in most states where the insurance companies are chartered to do everything they can to maximize profitability. And on top of that, they're subject to shareholder suits if some of their shareholders think they're not doing that. So they're simply doing what they're built to do, and that is to create wealth for their owners. They're just doing too much of it. So this is not a failure of the insurance industry. This is a failure of public policy, which has been dealt with much more effectively in other countries. This is a failure of public policy. This is a failure of our politicians to act on behalf.
Well, I see. This is where I start to disagree with you, because at the end of the day, the point of what I was ultimately saying was that the system costing that much to a doctor today is certainly the fault of the politicians, but it's in the system they've constructed. I mean, one of the reasons why the insurers are so expensive, you know, it's very easy and popular to blame it on greed, you know, and let's not pretend like greed is not part of the equation. But what the reality is that they have shouldered so much cost given government mandates and what an insurer is required to do and what they're not allowed to do at the same time, that they basically are trying to squeeze every nickel out of everything they possibly can because they're so restricted in other ways. The insurance companies that we have today are not allowed to design responsive insurance policies. You know, Nick over there in the audience for me is, what are you now, 27?
29.
29. Wow, all right, I gave him 2 years off there. But he's a young man, very healthy. There's really very few health requirements that he has the need to have insurance for, but probably would like some basic coverage, maybe to be seen once in a while for, you know, a physical and a checkup here and there and whatnot. But the insurance policy he's required to carry is light years more expensive than it would be in a pure market-based insurance system if one were to exist. And that's primarily because the government has basically stepped in and said, you are required to do the following things, because we're attempting to try to share the risk pool as much as possible to the broader population, particularly people who have more healthcare needs. So because of that, the insurance system as it currently stands is a real mess, and it's incredibly expensive. But there are things that can be done that don't involve the government that I think make absolute leaps and bounds toward delivering care directly to people, that I think we should really seriously look at as a model that does not involve $32 trillion. Just as a little mini example, one thing that we've worked at quite significantly over the past couple of years is trying to promote the direct primary care industry, which I'm sure some folks here are familiar with. But basically, these are doctors that do not participate in insurance. They have their patients essentially pay them a retainer on a month-to-month basis. It's usually somewhere in the neighborhood of $50, and they have essentially unlimited access to the doctor. So you don't use it for 7 months, great, but if you get the flu, you go in, you talk to the doctor, they see you, it's all part of the plan, essentially. You're paying for sort of overall coverage for the year in that way. They don't have the insurance, so none of the compliance stuff, none of the nonsense of dealing with insurers, none of the reimbursement nonsense comes into play. They basically have a direct relationship with you, the patient, and see you in that direct manner and get paid from you, which is a very inexpensive payment. Obviously, that's not all of your healthcare needs, clearly. But one of the things that makes that a less attractive option to the world at large is that you are still legally required here to have, if you're going to be taking patients like that, they have to have insurance of some kind. And we can't offer a truly catastrophic insurance plan, which would be extremely cheap with very few payments and reimbursements. They have to have an expensive insurance plan. And then so this, on top of that, is not really financially feasible. So while we still do have a lot of those doctors around the state and around the country, one in Scarborough, Dr. Champy, is very well known. There's also one in Hamden, Dr. Forbush, who we've worked with. He's a good guy. It's not as cultivated as I think it could be if there was some flexibility afforded to people to be able to actually buy insurance plans that were far cheaper and covered far less, legally speaking. That's a huge step forward in healthcare delivery, because it starts to restore the doctor-patient relationship that you're always hearing politicians go on and on about, to a much more small and singular relationship between people.
Two quick questions.
Yeah, of course. Go ahead.
One, when you talk about doctors have to have insurance, are you talking about that they need to have malpractice insurance? Is that?
Well, yeah, they have to have malpractice insurance. But when you see a doctor like that, I mean, if you have any sort of medical needs that are not covered in some fashion, you have to have insurance to
for yourself
cover that gap.
Yeah,
yeah.
It's news to me that $50 a month is a tier that is available. What I have heard is that Dr. Champy, for example, it's $2,500 a year to have access to that practice. Now, I'm not sure if that's correct or not, or maybe that was just starting out. But in these,
I think it's the difference between an individual and a family plan, or there's a variety of things he has. But yeah, we've done significant research on it. For an individual who has, basically Nick's healthcare needs, it's around that cost.
Okay. All right. So what other examples? So, for example, we've heard that one approach is to simply say, we're going to deal with this on a single-payer basis. We have the example of Medicare, which has a lot of difficulties of its own. But one of the things that, if I understand correctly, is true about Medicare is that the actual administrative cost as a percentage of the costs of the system are much, 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 I mean, less than a percent 3 years ago. So that's one thing in its favor. On the other hand, we have seen in the last, I think, 2 years, you probably better know better than me, 4 hospitals in Maine have closed, small hospitals, rural hospitals. And one of the things that they have cited is the fact that many or most of their patients are Medicaid or Medicare payees, and they are not able to operate with that level of reimbursement. So the question then becomes, if we are talking an approach that is similar to a Medicare for all, which we're hearing out of candidates now, would that be sufficient to deal with the kind of problems that you've brought up? And I know you've looked into this a bit. What would your reaction to that kind of question be?
Well, my initial reaction is that moving to a Medicare for all system doesn't mean we have to stick with Medicare rates. They'd have to go up. Okay. What's important about Medicare for all is that commercial insurance companies use underwriting to price their policies, as I explained earlier. That requires a great deal of administrative work. The largest department in most insurance companies is the actuary department. These are people who are paid to price risk. So the higher your risk of using medical care, the higher your premium. Medicare deals with risk in an entirely different way. Instead of segmenting people into little risk pools, you know, using whatever data they can acquire, some of it very intrusive, such as your past medical history, your occupation, your marital status, where you live, and so on. Medicare pools everybody into the same pool, which instantly does away with medical underwriting and all of the administrative complexity of medical underwriting. So that is a fundamental difference. Another fundamental difference between Medicare and Medicaid and the commercial insurance companies is that Medicare and Medicaid were established to facilitate care for people, whoever was eligible for those programs. And the more eligibility requirements you pile on, the higher the administrative cost and the higher the complexity goes. So Medicare and Medicaid were established to facilitate access to medical care. Commercial insurance companies are established to create wealth for their investors. They have to do this. This isn't a question of some greedy CEO, because if the greedy CEO didn't milk every bit of profit out of that enterprise that he reasonably could, as I mentioned earlier, he'd be subject to shareholder suits and all kinds of nasty consequences. So there's a clash of missions here. There's a fundamental clash of missions. Do you want a program that is designed and intended to facilitate your access to medical care, or do you want a program which is designed and intended to enrich shareholders? And the way they enrich shareholders is to minimize their payouts, what they call their medical losses. And that means denying claims, delaying claims, challenging clinical decisions. That motivation goes away entirely with public programs, because they're established for a very different purpose. And I think we have to kind of get over the hang-up we have in this country that goes back to the founding of thinking big government programs, by definition, are bad. That's just demonstrably untrue. And taxes are bad. I mean, is our taxes we pay for our police protection, is that a bad thing? Or our public roads? If we're going to be a civilized place, and I think we're at a very interesting political inflection point in this country right now, but if we're going to be a civilized country, taxes are the price of civilization, and government is the mechanism of enforcing a civilized society.
I have to stop.
You're listening to a WERU special. This discussion of universal health care was recorded on October 14th in Belfast. You just heard from Dr. Phil Caper of Maine All Care. Matt Gagne of the Maine Heritage Policy Center is speaking next. Jim Campbell was the moderator.
I have to stop you there, though, because the idea that, while you're correct about the differing motivations of government and private entities, at the same time, governments are not immune from the need and desire, frankly, to deny claims. Medicaid does it all the time. Medicare does it all the time. The VA, ask a veteran of what the VA is like. It has different considerations, and cost is actually one of them, because you have to be able to fund the programs that these government entities are paying out. And I just want you to consider the position that currently all Western nations currently find themselves in, okay, including the United States. The United States budget deficit this year will hit $1 trillion. They're not alone. The United Kingdom, France, Spain, obviously the Greeces and the Italies of the world, they're all in that same position. They are carrying an enormous amount of debt right now, right? One of the reasons Europe has been able to do what they've been doing over the years is, frankly, because of NATO. I don't want to get into a foreign policy conversation, but NATO is a common defense treaty, and the United States has largely underwritten most of the cost of that for the last, 50, 60 years. Because of that, they're not paying a lot of money in their defense budgets that they would otherwise be paying. I mean, they just would be spending it themselves rather than having us. And it makes a lot of sense why it's like that. I'm not trying to defend it or attack it right now, but it's a reality. And you could make the case that perhaps by cutting our defense budget in half, just as an example, you could start to pay for some of this type of program. It's fine. It's a good argument. But at the same time, you have to understand what that would do to these European nations that are currently being underwritten by that defense spending, right? We have bases in Germany. We have bases in France and the United Kingdom for very specific reasons. And if we're spending half of what we did, they're not there anymore. And they're going to be spending it on their own, which is going to increase their own budget deficits. Cost is an unbelievable factor that you have to keep in mind here. And they're already having trouble meeting their bills, and so are we. So if we were to shoulder on top of that a new cost that's basically twice what we're paying today in our overall budget for this new program, you're now shouldering that on top of the debt that we already have, and the taxes would be out of this. I mean, the estimates have shown that they have to be at least doubled, if not more, maybe tripled. And it's not a small consideration. I'm willing to pay taxes too for things that are important, but there's a level that we have to ask ourselves what will make actual sense in terms of society and what will actually work and what will not work. And when you do that kind of thing in that kind of monumental shift, I think you're playing with a lot of fire for the United States going in that direction.
So Phil has proposed an approach anyway to paying for Medicare that is over time at least accessible to all. You have agreed that that's a good idea.
People having health care is a good idea.
Right, in the big picture. You don't think that the type of government funding that is being discussed here is a good way to do it. You gave one example of a particular approach that might help with, very basic access mm-hmm. to primary care doctors. Do you think there is a solution? Or is this a situation that does not have a solution, and therefore, even though we believe that it would be a great idea for everyone to have access to health care, it's just not something that we can do?
Yeah, I think you're asking two questions there. The first question is there another system you could do? Like, if you made me emperor for the day and I came up with something, or you made anyone else here emperor for the day, could they come up with something that was better than what we have now?
I think that's clearly true.
Right, that's clearly true in a variety of different ways, including mine. I could probably describe to you a, libertarian paradise of how I would design a system. But the second question, I guess, it sort of relates to that first question. It's what's actually going to have any sort of political possibility for actually passing, right? Whatever I would tell you is an idea that I have has no chance in hell of passing anywhere, right? And to be perfectly frank, neither does Medicare for All right now. I mean, I understand that, in recent four or five years past, that it has increased in popularity and that more politicians are running on it or whatnot, but the United States political system is essentially set up to make sure that it'll never pass. I mean, it just will not. You have to have 60-plus votes in the Senate. You have to have a president that's interested in doing it. You have to have a Congress that has enough votes to make that happen. A lot of these districts that have Democrats in them today are districts that will not support that happening, even with a Democratic representative, and the level to which you would have to dominate Congress in order to actually pass Medicare for All, the Bernie Sanders plan or any other one, is beyond reasonable possibility today if you're a booster of Medicare for All. So I hate to be the bringer of doom and gloom, but I think that in the foreseeable future, in the next 5-10 years at least, you're really dealing with the system we have and trying to tinker with it in some fashion, as much as no one is happy with that, right? I'm certainly not. I know you're not. It is, I think, what the political reality of the next 10 or so years is. And as a result, to sort of try to answer your question, because I know you were trying to get an idea or two out of me, I think the real answer is to try to do things within the system that make it a little bit better every year. You know, just try to do anything you possibly can. An example that that we worked on in the Maine Heritage Policy Center, for instance, tried to tackle the issue of cost in the state of Maine. We worked on a bill called Right to Shop, which passed a couple years ago now. And essentially what it sought to do was try to find some way of introducing a market competition model into healthcare costs. Because if you're not too familiar with what hospitals and doctors and whatnot invoice for medical care in a variety of different ways, it can vary wildly in cost. And there's a lot of reasons why. It's the deal you've cut with insurers versus the Medicare rate versus the out-of-pocket rate if you're paying with cash. But you know, you can have cancer care that's delivered, you know, in one place for $30,000, and then across the street it's $5,000. You know, that happens pretty frequently across the United States for hip replacements, knee replacements, you name it. And one of the main reasons is because there's no mentality of cost in your mind as a consumer if you're consuming healthcare. If I have to have a knee replacement, I'm told I need to have a knee replacement. I make the appointment and I go get the knee replacement. And then I think of cost after the insurance bill comes to my house and I see what it is, and then I fight with somebody over it and so on and so forth. But it's after the fact, and there's really no mentality of trying to compare and contrast what that cost is. There have been some private businesses that have been running their own insurance programs internally for years that have actually engaged in some sort of system whereby they actually take the Maine Health Data Organization information about what a lot of these procedures cost across the state and elsewhere. They start shopping around, and when somebody needs something done, they actually find a place that does it at a dramatically reduced rate. Where this oftentimes is Mass General. It's oftentimes bigger hospitals that have more capacity, and they have, you know, they have a sort of broader base. And so they will literally fly people there, buy their meals, you know, have them overnight in a hotel room and do all those types of things to make sure that they are comfortable as they go to their procedure, but they still save $10,000, $20,000 out of it. And these private insurers, I guess you'll call them, have been able to actually hold down costs in their healthcare plans to the point where they're actually starting to add benefits and the company is starting to reap rewards from it. So we passed a bill a couple years ago that essentially tried to expand that type of offering in Maine via the traditional insurance system. I could complain about how it's been implemented, but the long story short on this is that basically it intended to get you as a consumer to try to keep those things in mind, find the lower cost option, and whatever the difference was in the cost between the average and where you end up going, you get in a personal reimbursement split between you and the insurer. So 50-50, what have you get a check cut to you, literally, or you get it off your deductible. And that keeps people thinking about cost. And when you do that more and more and more, you're going to start to see the market prices equalize a little bit and costs come down. And hopefully that's one little thing that can be done to try to make the current system better without really changing much, because at the end of the day, that doesn't really fundamentally alter much of the insurance system right now. And what was cool about it was that we had bipartisan support on it. It actually passed unanimously with acclamation because it had a lot of insurance protections on there, and it also had a lot of sort of market capitalism stuff in there too. So those kinds of ideas are possible, but they're nibbling at the edges, and I'll admit that they're nibbling at the edges, but I think it's what's politically feasible right now.
That's interesting, because Phil said earlier that the problem that we have is not a financial problem, it's not a medical problem, it's a political problem. Mm-hmm. What's your solution to the political problem then?
Public education. To put it in a concise way. One of the, I'm trained as a physician, and I was trained to look for the underlying pathologies, look past the signs and symptoms, and look for the underlying pathology. And when I ask myself, what's the underlying pathology of our healthcare system? It's not high costs and inadequate access and unhappy doctors and so on. Those are all symptoms. What's the underlying disease? The underlying disease is that treating healthcare as a for-profit business is unique to the United States of America and is pursued in no other country in the world because of the fact that the mission of business is to create wealth for its owners. And is that really what you want the mission of your healthcare system to be? Do you want your doctor making decisions based upon what's most profitable for the hospital he or she works for? Is that really who you want to turn your life over to? And I think that is a serious perversion of the fundamental mission of healthcare. And the whole notion of shopping for healthcare, you know, is frankly, I find it kind of silly because you need certain elements for markets to work. You need to have the financial resources. You have to have the money to buy the product, whatever it is. You have to be able to make a dispassionate decision, understand what's in your best interest, and pick the product that best suits you. And you need to have information about the quality of the product. I can think of no field where there is less transparency, where the customer, where the buyer of products and services, that's the patient, that's their employer, that's the taxpayer, whoever it happens to be. I can think of no field where there's more inequality in information. I mean, I, as a pretty highly trained physician, am incapable of making intelligent decisions about what kind of insurance I'm going to need to have. I'm incapable of making a judgment about what the optimal treatment would be, because when I first go to see the doctor, I don't know, and the doctor doesn't know. And that, so you need a system that is kind of blind to that court. You know, to expect the consumer to make an intelligent choice is just I think it betrays a lack of understanding about healthcare and what medicine is. I've seen an erosion. You know, when I was in training 50 years ago, a long time, healthcare was a mission-driven enterprise, and the doctors called the shots, and the people working for the doctors, the hospital, we used to call them hospital administrators. We now call them CEOs. We used to call doctors and nurses. They're now called providers. We used to call patients. We didn't call them consumers. We used to call services. We didn't call them product lines.
I don't want to jump in here, but that was in a system that was far more free market and profit oriented than today.
Not true. Let me give you a statistic. You know, I sort of say, I asked you why people like Medicare is much more popular and politically invulnerable than commercial insurance. I'm still in the ACA, so I'm still waiting for an answer to that question. You may want to think about it a little bit longer. But you have to ask the question, we're paying in Maine what may be the highest cost of medical care in the world, because we're at the top of the cost curve within the United States, and the United States has the highest cost in the world. You have to ask, where is the money going? Where's all that money going? If the doctors are unhappy, if the primary care doctors don't feel they're being paid enough, if the hospitals are going bankrupt, where's it going? The answer to that question is, if you look at the market capitalization, that is the equity worth of all of the healthcare companies, for-profit companies, insurance companies, drug companies, medical device companies, and so on, you have to ask, what's happened to their market cap since the ACA was enacted? It's doubled.
Of course it's doubled, because the initiation of the ACA actually had a requirement that you were able to, you were required to purchase health care. It was guaranteed issue of consumers into their pockets. And this is exactly why I have such a problem with big government, because you were talking earlier about why people have a problem with it. I have a problem with it because the bigger that it gets, the more there's an incentive for the insurers and everyone else to get involved in the system, you know, give as much money to politicians to get as many sweetheart deals as possible cut for them. This is the absolute definition of crony capitalism at its worst. One of the reasons they make so much money is because they have gamed and set up the system to the benefit of themselves. And the bigger you make it, the more that happens at top to bottom. And the system that we were talking about when you were beginning your story about what it used to be like had far less government involvement, far less government mandates, far less regulation on the system. And somehow at that time, it was cheaper and you had much more doctor-patient relationships that were forged by people with these people out of your lives. I just think about that. If you don't think that, that matters of life and death can be market-driven, I mean, ask yourself about food. There's no government entity that is trying to centralize the collection of food and then distribute it to you, the consumer. Yet we all go get food, and people are taken care of who are unable to afford it through, you know, through WIC and through food stamps and through a number of government programs that try very hard to have a basic safety net there for the people that are not able to purchase it. But at the end of the day, the system itself is entirely profit-driven and capitalistic, and yet you're still eating. So just keep that in mind, because I do not have an objection to the government being involved in a very broad sense in the healthcare industry to try to make sure that people are not lost, right? Particularly for the poor, particularly for people under certain, you know, levels of poverty. I think that it's entirely appropriate for the government to be involved in that. What I very much resist and I blame for a lot of the current problems with the system that we experience today is their, you know, year-by-year encroachment and growth involved in the system, creating more mandates and more involvement in the regulatory environment and so on and so forth, that has just spiraled costs out of control and made it far, far more lucrative for a company to get involved and try to game the system to their advantage. It happens in a variety of different industries, by the way. It's not just healthcare. It happens in a lot of them. I mean, go look up the FedEx and UPS disputes and some of the things that have happened there. That's some weird stuff that happens in the government when you get big.
I would like to go back to Phil. When I said, what do you think is the political solution? And you just said better education. Right. But anything more specific?
Well, I used to work at a point in my career in the United States Senate. I worked there for 7 years in the early 1970s. Incidentally, when we were spending about $100 billion a year on health care in this country and thought that was too much. Okay, we're now spending 30 times as much, and we're beginning to reach a point where people are finally beginning to push back.